Wow, what a morning. I bet you we're the only church in the whole world that has the speaker and everyone with squares around them. I mean, you know how much time that took to just perfect that? I mean, that was ridiculously amazing. Actually, this is our third camera this morning. When I arrived at 9:30, we were all systems go. We're here in Tyler's place. The whole Pierce clan has surrounded us. I feel quite intimidated. And in fact, I was going to sing happy birthday to me. Then I realized that Chris Pierce over here is also a father. So that wouldn't be very fair if I just sang it to myself. I actually sang it to my dad and Meryl's dad this morning, but I don't think either of them actually heard me. So welcome. It's fabulous in Father's Day. Now, I'm very aware that for some, Father's Day is a very traumatic day. It could be that your father has passed. You might not even know your dad. For others, it was maybe an abusive or an absent father situation. So amidst the celebration, we're not insensitive to the pain and trauma that some go through every year this time. I want to read from Numbers chapter 13. It seems probably quite a peculiar passage on this Father's Day extraordinaire message moment. But let's dive in and hopefully you'll understand why. Then Moses, this is Numbers 13, picking up in verse 17. Then Moses sent them out to spy the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests or there are not. Be of good courage. Bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land. Verse 23, then they came to the valley of Eshcol and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. They carried it between two of them on a pole. This was the sheer enormity of the beauty and the wonder and the fruitfulness of the valley. Two men had to carry it, and they brought some pomegranates and figs. I mean, this is fiesta time extraordinaire. And the place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Now this is looking really good. I mean, this must be a very fruitful land. There are valleys, there is water. Look at the fruit, the pomegranates, the figs, the grapes. This is a super cool gig that God has gifted them with. And they said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is the fruit. Nevertheless, but the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Well, who is that? We'll find out. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea along the banks of the Jordan. Then Caleb quietened the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. Well, hang on a second. Is this the land of valleys and rivers and water and pomegranates and figs and massive grapes? Well, actually, there are some super large giants here. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, come from the giants. And we like grasshoppers in our own sight. There's the issue. And so we are in their sight. Now, my wife, Meryl Diane, and my children are the lovers of classical literature, sci-fi and fantasy literature. And it was mulling over these two stories, the spies who saw the giants, and the reference to Lord of the Rings, the great Japanese anime film material, that landed me in the space of forging or forming giant slayers. I know it's a little kitschy-ish, but I think the idea is a really good one. Dr. Meg Meeker, in a great TED talk, said this. Since the 70s, there's been an unmatched assault against dads on television, music, and movies. In fact, she says, he is often the idiot that mom, granny, or even the 11-year-old child can help. She says there are three questions that fathers answer for their children. She said that dads are an authority unmatched by any other person in their lives. Now, before I read what the three questions are, let me give you context for her. She's a pediatrician. She's an author of 6 books. Nothing in what she said pointed to being an evangelical conservative Christian. The years that now she's 57, and all the years from her mid-20s to 57, her years in dealing with children and parents, her conclusion is what I'm about to walk you through. With great passion in her TED Talk, one of the most compelling, convicting talks, not necessarily in oratory skill, but in content. And she said this, remember she said that dads have an authority unmatched by any other person in their lives. Here are the three questions dads have to answer. One, Dad, what do you believe about me? What do you believe about me? What do you think about me is what she's saying. Am I capable? Am I dumb? Am I stupid? Kids get the answer, she said, not just with words, but reading your face and body language, dads. Question number one, Dad, what do you believe about me? Question two, Dad, how do you feel about me? How do you feel about me? Am I lovable? Am I good? Are you embarrassed by me? Are you ashamed of me? Question two. First question, what do you believe about me? Question two, how do you feel about me? Question three, Dad, what are your hopes for me? Do you believe in me? Do you have hopes for me? Dad, do I have a future? She said, kids that don't have these questions answered by their dads live in chaos. In fact, she said, Our prisons are filled with men whose spirits are crushed because they never had those questions answered by their dads. Dad, what do you believe about me? Dad, what do you feel about me? Dad, what are your hopes for my future? Or do you hope for my future? She tells the story of when she was 16, she decided she wanted to go to medical school. And so for the next 5 years, she focused exclusively on getting herself ready for that. She got good grades, got her undergrad program done, and at 21, living in Boston, she sent out her applications to all the medical schools she wished for. One by one, they replied with rejection. Can't do it, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it. Sorry, thank you for applying. It's not going to happen. She was devastated, as you can well imagine. For the last 5 years, her single focus was, with no plan B, I'm going to become a doctor. Not a pathologist like her dad. She didn't want to look at dead people all the time, but something else. So when she got her last letter of rejection, she went for a run. She came back home and she walked past her dad's den or his home study. And her dad was not a very communicative man, quite eccentric, she said. But as she walked past her study, she heard him mention her name. And being a really good 21-year-old daughter, she decided to eavesdrop. And her dad said something like this to whomever he was talking to on the other side of the phone. He said, yes, Megan is going to medical school within a year or two. And she said, as she stood there as a 57-year-old woman, you could see she was moved by emotion as she was that day as a 21-year-old when she believed her dad answered all three of those questions to her. I believe in you. I feel love, affection, adoration for you, and I see you have a future. And she said, as she stood there, a 57-year-old, that same sense of affirmation, it was a conversation her dad in future years didn't even remember, but they answered those three questions for her. Dad, what do you believe about me? Dad, what do you feel about me? Dad, what do you hope for my future? Now, one of the things I love about the church, as you know, I have 3 kids. And I am very grateful for that. Meryl and I on Friday night actually had a date night. We bought some really cool food, went to Corona Del Mar, looking out over Newport over the entrance there, and we had this delicious meal. I had a little G&T on the side, and we started talking about fathering, Father's Day, obviously. And it was quite a tender moment, to be very honest. It kind of unzipped me a little bit. Because we were talking about the things I did well and the things I did not do well. But what I loved is that the story of my kids, maybe less T, but the girls definitely, was what Dad did not offer, what Dad could not do. It's just a fallen, broken human being. Church community and the other fathers in the church filled. Nick Soltis, I'm preaching for him tonight, was one of those father figures to Dana and Stu who poured into their lives in the mid-turbulence of their pre-marriage relationship. See, I love it. Community or church is not, well, three mates meeting on a Friday for a munchie. Well, that's our church. No, it's not. It's great fellowship. But church is multi-generation, where fathers father, and the church gets healthier, and the church, the dads pour into the community those three questions. But it's not just, dear friend, it's not just about, Dad, do you believe in me? What do you feel about me? And what do you hope for my future? I want to suggest that dads also add to the skill set what it will take to be a warrior, a fighter, a soldier for the next chapter when the kids take over from us. Richard Rohr, and I mentioned this before, but I want to just touch on it again, is a social anthropologist in the Catholic Church. He's a father. I don't really like his theology, but I love his social anthropological studies. And he came out studying global initiation of men around the world. And he said all the initiations point to five things that young men are taught during that transition moment, 16 to 21. One, they are taught that life is hard. Two, that, let me find my notes here, that you are not that important. Son, you are not that important. Three, your life is not about you. Four, you are not in control. And five, you are going to die. I always chuckle at the last one. When you think you're never going to die and the world is at your feet and everything is before you, to be landed with that final declaration over you. A commentator of his writing said this: it's actually quite a startling recommendation to read in the midst of a pain-averse suburban culture in which I live, the author said. He says, don't run from it. Don't avoid it. Don't prematurely end it, but let it do its work in you. Allow God to transform that pain and redeem it, and you in the process. His brilliant line is, if we don't transform our pain, we will transmit it. Now, what do we have here? We have Meg giving us this incredible picture of the three essential conversations we dad put into our kids. That's the foundation. Then building on top of the foundation is readying them for their life's assignment. It's not to mollycoddle, not to overly protect or helicopter them, but it's to posture and position them for the giants that they will have. You know, Israel, this is not a political statement. It's a social reality. Every young kid in Israel knows they will go to war. Every one of them. Every one of them gets trained, male and female alike. Great reading, Startup Nation, the story of Israel's economic miracle. And they talk about the impact that military readiness has created within the Israeli culture. My job as a father, both biologically and spiritually, is to ensure that I lay a foundation of those three questions in all of your hearts and lives, but then add to it the skills, the weaponry to go and fight. There comes a day, dear friend, when my race is run. Paul said, my race is run. I'm done. I fought the great fight. But now the fight is in your hands. My father grew up as a generation where they were seen as protectors and providers. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's not enough. It's way more. In fact, he's listening to me in South Africa right now. It was beautiful, but it wasn't enough. There's way more to fathering, but that's what he knew. But he had his giants. In fact, I was quite tender, Dad, thinking about the giants you had to fight. Because I don't think we sons think often enough about the battles our dads had. He had to fight fatherlessness. His dad died. My grandpa died when my dad was 12. He had to grow up with what in South Africa was called poor whites. I know it doesn't translate into America, but it was what they were. At the age of about 14, my dad got shoved off to live with some distant aunt, and he had to be a postman by day and go to night. versus high school. Can you imagine 14 to 17, be a postman by day and to work at night to do home schooling at a technicon at night? He had to cope with aloneness because there was no dad. The family was scattered because of the poverty in the family. He had to forge his own story within not being educated, being the underdog, and cultural Christianity. I mean, I can say more, but the point is, at times we sons forget what giants our dads had to slay. My giants was I grew up with white privilege in South Africa. I didn't even think about it growing up. It's just what was real. Racism was all around me at every turn. And it was the realization of how blatant, deep, and dreadful racism was that got me to preach against it, have conferences against it, march against it. Because it's brutal, destroying a family and individuals. We had to fight the rise of communism in Africa. I was a soldier. And what I really believed was I had to stem the tide of socialism and communism that was fighting its way down through Africa, one country at a time. And on our doors in Angola and Mozambique, there were communist regimes that were there, and I had to put on my fatigues and I had to go to combat. It was a giant I had to slay. Traditionalism and the bondage that it brings, white nationalism, which defended itself on every turn. And Jesus, well, he was a nice white suburban hero. And I had to slay that. I remember when I first came here, 1996, 97, I was watching a History Channel. And I have a curiosity with the Vietnam War, a war we should never have fought. And they were interviewing some white soldiers, ex, and some Vietnamese ex-soldiers. And one man particularly had a huge impact on my life. And it was a Vietnamese man. And while he was talking in Vietnamese and it was translated, it was a tear that rolled down his cheek. And they asked him, why did you come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail? Why did you come in spite of the American planes coming over and bombing and all that went with the war? And he said, because we realized if we did not win the war, our kids would have to fight to win. And I remember that stayed with me. And since then, which is now about 25 years, I've mulled so often, what are the battles I have to fight? Because my kids will have their own battles. I can't afford to give them mine. And then they fight their battles. Like David, we have to give our young men and women five stones. We have to be able to give them the skills needed to fight their battles. Protecting them is not going to deal with it. Folks, we don't choose our giants. Well, I'm going to fight you, but I'm not going to fight you. No, heck, every generation has its giants and they will choose you. I did not choose to fight racism in South Africa. I did not want to have weeks and weeks of prayer and fasting, crying out to God for a nation that was burning. I did not choose that. I did not choose to go to the army and be a soldier. You see, our giants choose us. They posture and position themselves in front of us. And we have to decide, will we bow to them like the 10 did? Are they too big? Now, I know there's fruit. I know there's incredible pomegranates and figs. I know they're beautiful. But you know what? No, I'm not going to fight them. Well, their sons and daughters had to fight them because they don't go away. Two said, oh, we can beat them. Let's take them right now. And the gift we can give is not just the three questions. It's not just the notion of the five ideas of initiation, but it is the fact, dear son and daughter, biological, spiritual, is that you've got your giants to fight. You are millennials and Gen Zs. You've got your own giants. Unfortunately, we leave you the residue of some of ours. We weren't tenacious enough, gutsy enough, persistent enough to defeat our giants. You should not be facing racism right now. We should have done a way better job. God gave us the opportunity in the 60s with civil rights. In South Africa, the opportunity was Nelson Mandela, 1994, when he got let out of prison. It was that great moment, but we dropped the ball. We didn't push through. In Afrikaans, we used to say, when you hit a target, you go direct deur die doelwit, which means you go straight through the objective. You don't hit to the edge of town fighting and then you stop. You clear out the enemy right through till the other side of town. We didn't do that. And for that, I apologize, because you picking up some of the battles we should have fought. With humility, compassion, and being strong and courageous, can I suggest four giants you will fight? I don't pretend to know it all. I certainly don't pretend to know who your giants are. Moses didn't find the giants. The next generation of leaders found them. But I think there are four possible giants. One is spiritual. There is a spiritual assault against who we are and what we believe. You will have to fight that one. The authority of Scripture, the power of the sacred text, is going to be one you will have to stand strong and firm with compassion and humility. It's being demeaned, it's being equated with other literature of myth and legend or other sacred texts equally, without being the authority of God for life and doctrine. Exquisite power to transform. We have surrendered that, or they want us to surrender that, to merely literature and curiosity in its interpretation. Jesus, we're being told by a growing voice of ex-evangelicals, really wasn't God. We must understand that, they say with great tolerance. We must understand he was just a man. He was maybe a philosopher like Buddha or Gandhi, you know, a great man. But at best, a prophet philosopher, not at all the redeeming God. And we know they will tell us that the atonement, you know, that really isn't redemption. Because if we understand atonement as we've been taught all these years, it's really nothing more than cosmic child abuse. No. The atonement isn't that. It's just living good lives, social justice, the kingdom now, and healthy culture. Oh, dear friend, my life was transformed because Jesus met me. And the power as a 19-year-old lying on the bed in my 18-year-old on the bed of my parents, and the realization that Jesus died for my sins. God came here to dwell amongst man, to take the sin for which I deservedly needed to be punished. He took that punishment upon himself, changed my life. It's not a philosophy or an ideation. It's a transformative moment that God gave me. The second area, and one can say much about that, is the soul assault. Identity, who am I? It's wonderful to see all the quest for authenticity. I love that about your generation. Suicide, why am I here wrestling with the very issues of meaning and purpose? And then anxiety. And we know that's on the increase. Every book, every article I read from psychology is talking with some confusion as to why there is this rise of anxiety and depression and uncertainty and suicidal thinking. But here's a quote from a psychological journal. It says, however, multiple studies have found a strong link between heavy social media and an increasing risk for depression, anxiety, loneliness, self-harm, and even suicidal thoughts. Social media may promote negative experiences such as inadequacy in your life and your appearance. My dear friend, it's a big battle you're going to have to fight. You're going to have to take on that which bombards the human soul, which gets me to live in continuous discontentment because I'm not living what others are presenting as the dream gig. We know it's not really true. But somehow the persistent whisper of social media gets us to believe I'm not pretty enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not strong enough, I'm not courageous enough, I don't have enough money. And it disarms me, weakens me at a time when strength and courage is what is needed. Thirdly, you still with me? I hope so. I can see you going off the screen there to get a cup of coffee. Societal assault. Societal, spiritual, soul, societal assault. David Brooks, my favorite New York Times journalist, in his book, The Second Mountain, said this. The central problems of our day stem from what he called hyper-individualism. Social isolation, distrust, polarization, rising suicide rates, rising mental health problems, a spiritual crisis caused by a loss of common purpose. This is going to be a big one. Strap your armor on tight. Make sure your weapon is clean. Make sure your soul is well preserved because someone has to cry out and fight this battle. Yes, it is about abortion. Of course it is. Those are lives that God created in the womb that we dispense of as if they're just little fetuses we can throw out in the trash can because we don't want them. Yeah, that's a longer term fight we've not done well at. But I think there are some other high points of justice and equality before the law, some economic disparity and climate issues. Pick up your sword. These need to be fought. And they need to be fought courageously. What we've oftentimes subliminally given to you as go to college, get a degree, get a good job, get a 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom, 5-bedroom house. No, that won't be the story of many of you. Many of you will live a quiet but persistent life, like a mongoose with a mamba, just gnatting away until eventually they kill the mamba, this dreadful giant that's slaying our beautiful, beautiful people around the world. Lastly, and I'm trying to land, is the sexual assault. The whole dystopia of sexual confusion. Well, we didn't really have to fight that one, but you will. I was on a Zoom call with India this past 2 weeks ago, and there was a beautiful young Indian woman, Rachel is her name, lives in Mumbai. Tells the story, the daughter of a pastor was sexually abused as a little girl, which happens, it's quite prolific in India, but no one talks about it. And it was in Christian community that one day as a woman, she was actually able to acknowledge the deep shame and trauma she went through living all these years with sexual abuse that she'd experienced as a little girl. But the moment it was out in the open, God, through His glorious Holy Spirit, could transform her. And her life is spent now going around India, talking at schools, and the lines after she's spoken of women who've come and said, "That's me, that's me, that's me," a humble woman, a beautiful woman. I just looked at her across the screen and I said, "Oh Lord, this is a prophetic woman. This is a woman who's gifted her life to set at liberty those who have been sexually abused when they were little innocent girls that should never have their innocence and virginity taken from them." Beautifully graced she is now. Deep forgiveness in her heart. See, she's taking on a giant in India. Can you imagine how insurmountable it must feel? 1.2 billion people. But with quiet, humble perseverance, one little girl's life changed at a time. She's taking on her giant. And you may say, "Chris, this is overwhelming. How on earth are we going to get that done?" Two stories quickly from South Africa and our land. I remember watching Nelson Mandela walk out of prison in 1994. After all the fighting that we had, after all the prayers and spiritual warfare and marching on the streets and feeling overwhelmed at times, this is never going to change. I remember watching that moment. It was a gift from God. It was a giant we slayed. Madiba, the father of the nation, as we so dearly and affectionately ended up calling him, if only he had lived just a little longer, if only he had been president of the nation a little bit longer, who knows what would have happened. But there was a moment about 4 years after that, no, a little bit longer, it doesn't matter. I was with T on the beach in Durban, had been preaching and took a moment to take him to the beach, and behind me, I heard two grommets, two young surfers talking, same accent, same vibe, same lingo franco, and I turned around, it was a black kid and a white kid, and you could not have told that had you not looked at them. And I looked at my boy and I said, "T, that's what we fought for. That's what we fought for, where these kids did not see each other on the color of their skin, but in the commonality of their friendship. We can slay the giant, but it takes some guts and some perseverance." Lastly, I close. What if God answers these three questions about you and me? God, what do you believe about me? Do you think about me at all? Do you think I'm capable? Or do you think I'm dumb? Do you think I'm stupid? God, what do you feel about me? Am I lovable? Am I good, or are you embarrassed or ashamed about me? Because I just keep sinning and I keep repeating. Are you ashamed about me? When my name comes up between Jesus and the angels, do you turn your head because I'm too much of an embarrassment for you? Dad, God, what are your hopes for me? Do you believe in me? Do you have hopes for me? Do I have a future? And on this Father's Day, that's where I want to end. Because I know the answer is yes, yes, yes. God believes in me. He created me in His image and His likeness, and He's transforming me into wholeness. He loves me. One of my transforming moments as a young Jesus lover was the moment I read in the Minor Prophets that God rejoices over me with dancing. And the picture, my imagination was the table, because so much of what I think happens at the table, and Father God pushes, in my culture, the dad always sits at the head, and the eldest son always at the foot. That's how we did it. And so my mind was Father God pushing the chair back. He's saying, Chris, and he starts singing about me, declaring His love for me, His affection to me, not stunned or stumbled or devastated by my proclivity to sinfulness and brokenness, but just dancing around me, singing His songs of affection over me. See, maybe your dad didn't do that for you, but there is one who is doing that for you. And may that be our Father's Day message. Can I pray for you? We need to hear you. As this young generation get padded up for the game, get armored up for the fight, they need to go out with that certainty. God, what do you believe about me? God, what do you feel about me? And God, what are your hopes for me? And I thank you, Lord, as we strap up for this next round of war, of spiritual combat, of the giants that need to be slayed, those questions are answered in you. I am your boy. Meryl is your girl. And you love us. You care for us. You believe in our stuttering, stumbling, faltering ways. And you have a future for us. Every day matters. God bless you all. Have a wonderful lunch. For those of you who are here in Southern California, enjoy the moment. Maybe give your dad, biological or spiritual, a text. No, he wasn't perfect. I'm not. But I'm so grateful at the privilege of parenting. God bless you all. Love you heaps. Till the next time.